But climate change is that juggernaut of change that requires an enormous global effort and genuinely profound systematic change. We cannot talk at the edges and we cannot play at the edges in terms of the challenge in front of us. We know that not acting will have even greater systems and transformational changes, but it will not be within our control and it will not be moving the world in the direction that we know it needs to go. So we need to step into the fray.
That was Victoria's Chief Health Officer, Professor Brett Sutton, highlighting the urgency of dealing with climate change. He was the keynote speaker on the first day, the first official day of the National Conference of the Doctors for the Environment, where the theme was A Time to Act.
Thank you, Manasa. Thanks to the organising committee for the invitation to come here today. It's absolutely lovely to be here. And I would also like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land on which I'm standing, the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation, and to pay my respects to elders past, present and emerging, and indeed to any First Nations people here today or online. And it's worthy of reflecting on the possibility that a voice to Parliament might bring the wonderful depth of understanding that our First Nations people have in terms of the stewardship and custodianship of the lands. That may well be a powerful opportunity should a voice to Parliament be established. I do reflect on exactly the wisdom that could be brought to bear through that voice to Parliament. Chief Health Officer is a statutory position in Victoria, but also provides advice on the breadth of public health matters to the Victorian Government. I am the Chief Human Biosecurity Officer as well. That's under the Commonwealth Biosecurity Act. It's not a secret ministry. It's a legitimate other job, trust me. So why now? Why the urgency? Why the criticality of acting? Because the profundity of the challenge in front of us is so very substantial. As you just heard from the Chair, we've been calling for action for a long time, but we've had decades of lost opportunity at the same time globally. And so the urgency of acting gets greater and greater. Unfortunately, in the mix of voices around the commentary, there's always been, oh, but you've called for this forever, and look, we're in no worse a position. The disinformation and misinformation that is circulating is profound. But I will come to that later. But make no mistake, we're at a juncture now where the tipping point is closer and closer by the day, and some of those changes will be locked in for literally hundreds of years, knowing the half-life of carbon dioxide that's released into the atmosphere, as well as other CO2 equivalent greenhouse gases. The positive side is that this is a profound opportunity for transformational systems change at the same time. So it's been called one of the greatest existential threats in the 21st century, and indeed it is. There are not many that you can list at that high level. Antimicrobial resistance just before the COVID pandemic was called one of them. excuse me, this is asthma, by the way, 5 times RAT negative, don't worry. But climate change is that juggernaut of change that requires an enormous global effort and genuinely profound systematic change. We cannot talk at the edges and we cannot play at the edges in terms of the challenge in front of us. We know that not acting will have even greater systems and transformational changes, but it will not be within our control and it will not be moving the world in the direction that we know it needs to go. So we need to step into the fray in the most substantial way in order to make sure that those transformational changes across society address this profound challenge. Lots and lots of stories in recent years, and again, this gets challenged in that misinformation, disinformation frame all of the time. Individual events, oh yes, we're a land of floods and fires and droughts and flooding rains. What we need to understand is that whenever we reference the dangers of climate change, we should talk about it in that probabilistic sense. Whatever individual causation you might place to a specific event, we have to recognise that year on year on year, we are moving into a space where the likelihood of these catastrophic events becomes greater. We can't ascribe every single one. There'll be some that would have occurred anyway. There'll be good years. There'll be La Niña years. There'll be deviations in various directions. But the trends, and this is the beauty of being able to talk about science in a nuanced way, and that's one of the great challenges for all of you here, to be able to talk about it as a growing challenge in terms of the likelihood of these catastrophic events. And this is just a spattering. And we've had very profound changes, especially in the southeast of Australia. It's been called out in the IPCC report. The southeast of Australia is particularly vulnerable. And the similarity to California, homes built amongst really substantial forested areas, are a real danger. They're a danger to life and limb, but they are also a danger to that broad population threats that we've seen in the 2019-2020 bushfires, when a pall of smoke was not just across East Gippsland, it was right across Melbourne metropolitan area, estimated over 400 deaths from the Grattan Institute, looking at some modelling. Huge numbers when you think about other causes of deaths from environmental and other hazards, non-communicable diseases in Australia. I haven't got footage of China's drought and 70-day heat wave. It is an extraordinary event in the world. It is unprecedented, but we keep talking about unprecedented only to find out it's happening routinely. The Loire Valley, where I had the great fortune of riding bikes with my family, what was it called? Cycling for Softies. Fantastic, beautiful trip along the Loire Valley, and the footage there to see the Vienne River, the Loire River, virtually disappear because of lack of rainfall is yet another reminder. The Swat Valley, where I've spent time in northwestern Pakistan, an absolutely gorgeous part of the world. The video footage, if you haven't seen it, is heartbreaking. It is absolutely devastating. When you realise the dependencies that especially lower middle income countries have in terms of where they can place their houses, where they can place their businesses, where they can do their agriculture, and the profound vulnerabilities that occur as a consequence of that, you'll see just how devastating those floods in the Swat Valley are, when entire villages are taken out, when those hotels, schools, homes are swept away in but moments. Why is climate change a health issue? Well, climate change, of course, it's an environmental issue, and we should not forget the intrinsic value of the environment in this equation. But it is not difficult to understand that our codependency, our deep interconnected relationship with the environment, means that our well-being and our health are profoundly and intimately linked with the state of the environment. We should also reflect on the fact that this is a powerful narrative in talking about climate change. Some people will want to be disconnected from the idea that this is a challenge to them personally in their health and well-being, and just say it's an environmental issue and I don't really need to care about myself, my family, future generations, because it's not really a health issue. But it is entirely a health issue, and I think it's very powerful to speak to the narrative about just how many ways directly and indirectly our health is affected. Extreme heat, again, the 2009 Black Saturday bushfires, the front pages rightly told the stories of people who died directly as a result of that bushfire, because they were profound tragedies. There were nonetheless, more people who died in the 4 days of heatwave over that Black Saturday period than died directly in those fires. And we should feel the tragedy of that as profoundly, and we should understand the risk at exactly that same level, because there will be years where we have extreme heat without catastrophic bushfires, and these people will die silently, many at home, many dead on arrival in the emergency department, or with heat stroke, heat exhaustion, and will struggle in our hospital system for their lives to be saved, because heat is a huge challenge to our physiological homeostasis when we have frailty and significant underlying conditions. Bushfires I've spoken of, but that's not just the direct effect of fire, that's air quality. It threatens our water supply as pumping stations get taken offline, as happened in 2019-2020 in Victoria, but also because the contamination of those catchments can be really substantial. And we had some flash flooding after those fires in Gippsland as well, including contamination in some of the catchments that supplied Melbourne metropolitan households. And it could have been worse. The Thompson Dam is a very substantial reservoir. Sylvan, Upper Yarra, also potentially affected. And having half of Melbourne not able to drink water, I think would bring some of this home to bear. Indirect effects: water quality, food safety. So every degree of heat increases the risk of contamination, bacterial contamination of food, just by virtue of how long it takes in our household settings, oftentimes, for that bacteria to grow to a point where it reaches a threshold that it can cause human illness. These happen at population levels individually. It doesn't seem so much, but when you're faced with significant foodborne outbreaks, again, it's brought home to bear. Ecological and land use change. So those people in the Loire Valley who are engaged in agriculture at vast scale, those vast areas of China that have had 70 days of drought and extraordinary heat have production losses that are absolutely profound and will affect their mental health by virtue of the way that it affects the economy, by virtue of the way that they are reflecting on the food insecurity, which is a huge issue in China. Ever since the Great Famine, it is deeply in the psyche of China about the supply of food. Social determinants. Whenever you think about existential challenges to health, the highly unfortunate corollary is that all of those social and economic inequities are amplified. Those challenges mean that the individuals who are least health literate, least able to navigate primary and tertiary health systems, least able to navigate the complex world of government, financial and other support, and are in circumstances at a household level, in terms of family, in terms of insecure work, in terms of casualised labour, that gets amplified by these challenges. And heat waves are a prime example. Homes that are less able to stay cool, that have less shade from tree cover, where individuals are less likely to identify significant illness and are more likely to have some of the preconditions for more severe illness. And then all of these health impacts. What isn't listed here, a lot of these things, again, deterministic or probabilistic, you can almost say, without exception, you will see more deaths from extreme heat year on year on year. The stochastic or black swan or left field events, they're not listed here. Those are the ones where a communicable disease comes out of the blue. It will be in some chaotic, you know, butterfly over the North Atlantic way connected to climate change, but suddenly significantly affects the health and well-being of Australia or of the population at large. I can't tell you what it is. It is probably not foreseeable. It is probably not able to be modelled, but because of that deep interconnection and dependency it could play out in the world, and we will be chasing our tails to manage it. What we do know is that to the extent that we can manage carbon dioxide emissions, we can reduce the risk of those black swan events happening. And communicable diseases are probably not thought about enough. Of course, climate change is not the only driver there. There's this significant interaction of the human-animal interface and food animals and wet markets that make zoonotic illnesses an increasing risk over time. And with international travel and with the growing population and with degradation of the environment and the biosphere, we have those challenges that are interplaying with climate change. What we do need to realise is that as we address climate change, that is not the only existential threat that we're facing, but it is that very explicit opportunity to be able to deal with some of these other existential challenges at the same time. And so why be ambitious in our actions? Why do we need to act right now? Because of this probabilistic effect. The more that we can do now, the greater the assurance that we can have that we can stay below that global commitment to 1.5 degrees. And we know already that if we add up all of the commitments of individual countries, we will not get to that 1.5 degrees based on those existing commitments. It is good to see that our national government has talked about its targets as a floor and not a ceiling. And it is great that the Victorian government has talked about a renewal of commitments to exactly what thresholds we will get to every 5 years, because we need to do that. We'll need to continually reflect on how we're tracking, how things are looking, and what it means. 1.5 degrees is not a good increase in global temperature. What we've got in front of us now is profoundly challenging, or bad, or catastrophic. Let's choose profoundly challenging as our best option and try and do even better than that. We're already at a point, again, and it varies around the globe geographically, we're already at a point where we've seen a temperature rise of 1 degree since 1910. That's the industrial era for us. In the future, we've got challenges both in terms of the average temperature in Victoria, but also sea level rise, the number of days of extreme heat. And I remember speaking to a group of students in Gippsland about that increase in temperature. And someone asked an entirely appropriate question. If it's just 1 degree, what does it matter? You know, we have a day of 16 degrees, we've got a day of 17 degrees. Well, that's not the issue. The issue is those huge excursions that happen in that probabilistic way, where you've got a day of 42 degrees when you've never had one before in Gippsland. That is the challenge that Victoria will face. Rain comes in more intense, short, heavy downpours. Alpine snowfall, the same challenge seen across the world. The drying up of the Loire Valley is one issue, but there's a decrease in the flows from glaciers, and that causes more flooding. But at some point, that flooding will go, but it'll be because there's no glacier left, and then there'll be profound challenges by virtue of being able to generate electricity from hydropower, but also all of those corollaries in relation to agriculture, life and livelihood. Double challenges here. Biophysical boundaries being transgressed is one scale in a kind of global picture. You can see the social thresholds that are achieved. These are for our health and well-being in the fullest sense of the word. The donut in the top left corner is where we would like to be, where the biophysical boundaries that comprise all of those things that go beyond just climate change, but relate to the preservation of all of those valued and intrinsically necessary elements of our environment for our well-being in the fullest sense, and the social thresholds that can be delivered through the services and the provision of supports in a country, but are often at odds with each other. we would like to be in the top left corner. Australia is in the top right corner, where those biophysical boundaries are being transgressed, even as we're delivering those social thresholds. And we shouldn't forget our sustainable development goals. We shouldn't forget the social determinants of health and that very strong interplay with climate change and its challenges. As I've said, low-income earners always overrepresented in these existential challenges, or indeed any crisis that threatens health. And this goes to both the threat and the opportunity. The Sustainable Development Goals are an opportunity to reset as we address mitigation and adaptation in our climate change responses, to have sustainable cities, affordable and clean energy. The madness of some of the inaction over decades is that we have lost an opportunity for economic growth in Australia with an industry that has been held back. It should have been profoundly supported across the political spectrum, because it was good for everything. It was good for everyone, good for economic growth, good for economic opportunity, good for jobs growth, and good for our health and wellbeing. And we should not forget that when we think about the mitigations that we can build in, that we should also think about adaptation. The Sustainable Development Unit in the UK, Angie Bone, my Deputy Chief Health Officer Environment in the third row, has reminded me that there's been a very large focus on the carbon footprint of those health services in the UK, but there can and should be really profound thinking about the adaptation that needs to happen in those settings as well. And as you think about the adaptation, what are those mitigations that can be built in as you adapt? But also, don't just focus on mitigation without an understanding of what the future emergent risks will be. We don't want a rosebud hospital on the Mornington Peninsula that has that is carbon neutral and is surrounded by 24 centimetres of water continuously. We have to think in a planning sense how to manage those threats of air quality, rising water level, all of the threats that will come with a changing climate. So what are we doing in Victoria? It's great to see lots of firsts, lots of fastests, lots of steepest declines, and very ambitious targets. There are very substantial commitments that have been made in Victoria. Again, Angie reminded me this morning of the 2030 commitment for carbon neutral water corporations across Victoria. They use a lot of energy, and they will have significant challenges in getting to those targets, but it is in setting the aspirations that we have any possibility of achieving them. And so it's great that those commitments are built in. It's great that there's a Climate Change Act in Victoria. It's great that our state's public health and wellbeing plan has climate change as one of its four key areas of action, and that we've got a climate change adaptation action plan that's now settled in the Department of Health and Human Services, and that there are seven other sectoral areas or departmental areas where climate change adaptation action plans are going to be embedded in Victoria. Got an environmental sustainability strategy. Guidelines for sustainability in health care capital works, a really important one in health settings. And there's been a lot of thinking about that, both in terms of design features, but the very detailed analytic work to understand how best to get the greatest energy efficiency from a design perspective, but also in the way that concrete is used, in the way that air source heat pumps are used, in the way that geothermal heat can be called upon. And it's never one thing. So don't think about your capital works in isolation from how long it takes to drive there, what support there is to electric vehicles, what support there is to public transport access to these settings, and so on and so forth. And here are the potential benefits. Here's the opportunity that we have. At the same time as we choose public transport and reduce the carbon output by virtue of our individual travel, It's an opportunity to reduce the PM2.5, PM10 and or diesel that might otherwise spill out into our ambient air quality. It's good for our individual health benefit by virtue of walking or cycling instead of driving. So there are many, many opportunities where we can embed this at a behavioural level that will be good individually and collectively. This is good news. There's a little bit of work to be done here, no question. Health being prioritised is a fantastic reflection. There's a ready acceptance that health is one of the main ways that climate change will affect us. And there's a hunger for more information. And so moving from unaware to aware is one of those easy steps, I think, with the 1,000 conversations that you can all have in weeks, months and years to come. And sensibly, and Stern and others would tell us this 1,000 times over, it is so, so much cheaper to act now and to act with ambitious intent than to be subject to the huge costs of inaction that will arise. That 67% needs to meet reality and be 100%, but that's what these conversations are about. And we need to get information out, but it's more than information. We need real engagement. I think there's always a place for campaign materials. There's always a place for online information, but the real tricky work is those individual, in-depth, nuanced conversations that you have. And I think we're in a time where the poison of misinformation and disinformation is more challenging than ever before. I've certainly felt it through COVID. I think the tools of those who promulgate misinformation and disinformation, and they've got powerful forces behind them that would love us to take no action whatsoever, or would love to give the impression that everyone cares and everyone's doing something while doing nothing at all. I think we have to recognise that the tools of those individuals are cherry-picking, taking things out of context, and taking memes that are emotionally engaging about individual lies or untruths and amplifying them to the fullest extent possible. We need to inoculate individuals from that kind of misinformation before they are confronted with it. There's a group at Cambridge who've done great work on the idea of pre-bunking, so debunking, but before you come across misinformation. I think that's really worthy of exploration, because we do a poor job when misinformation has spread very widely and people are deeply embedded in those falsehoods. We have to say, this is the misinformation that you should expect. This is why it's not right. And this is where you can go to for the right information and how you can validate it. Because people want to know that they are intelligent and rational in how they appraise the facts of the world. And so we need to give them the tools to make sure that they're going in the right direction and not just having an amplified social network feeding back the same bullshit that we've been through with COVID. And Antonio Guterres says it better than anyone. Every fraction of a degree matters. Every voice can make a difference and every second counts. You all have a huge opportunity here. I think it's very clear that doctors' voices are trusted. It's very clear that there have been some challenges in science communication over the last few years. At the same time, there is still a very, very strong trust in the voices of science in Australia, and we need to use that opportunity. There are many, many ways in which you can change the narrative. There are opportunities to change legislation, regulations, guidance, policy settings. Take every opportunity, get connected with the networks within your communities, get connected with your colleagues who feel the same way, have influential conversations with people who are hungry for more information, who want to know what's going on, and be deeply involved in those opportunities to advocate, because there are opportunities to change legislation and there are opportunities to change the general conversation in the community that becomes the front news story or that becomes the things that politicians read that actually influence them to to change. And so do not underestimate the power that you've got to have an upswelling of the genuine concern that we have as a community for the threats that are facing us going forward, so that we can all act to the fullest extent possible for our health and wellbeing. Thank you.
Well, we've reached the end of this episode of Climate Conversations. Thanks so much for your company. So until we talk again, please take care, stay safe, and please be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. And should you have enjoyed this episode, please feel free to share with your friends. And in the meantime, take care.